أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين وأصحابه المنتجبين. Firstly, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the Ismaili Center for having organized such an event to celebrate the life of an individual who is arguably the most influential person in creation. A person which the Quran says is Rahmat lil Alameen. And by default, he is a person who is a mercy, the way that we translate over mankind. But if you go into detail, you'll find that he is a mercy over all of creation itself, whether it's the physical world or the metaphysical world. And so in this way, naturally this pluralistic approach that the Quran uses to explain him and to mention him is something that I think is fundamental for us to understand today if we're going to see where Muslims are going to really end up. With that, I think it's important, therefore, to break this session really into three parts. The first reality is the reality of God. And what does God believe when it comes to the spiritual plurality? And in the same way, the reality of the Prophet in the way that he acted, in the way that he came into this world, and especially the way that he implemented law, the way that he implemented kindness over the people. But the most important thing, I think, after that is the legacy of the Prophet and how we perceive the legacy of the Prophet as Muslims today. So really, come with me on a journey in the next 40 minutes. I'm going to start off on a cosmological, kind of ontological argument and slowly break it through to more practical terms. In reality, they say, and this is something which is found across mysticism generally, whichever religion you adhere to, there is a principal core there, an esoteric reality. And this reality is something which is transcendent. It's the same within all religions, from the very beginning of time and to the end of time. You find that all religions have a reality there, an esotericism. And despite the fact that we may have different kind of rituals and practices, but essentially from the core we're the same. And to give you an example, if you look 5,000 years ago and you look at the spread, for example, of Hinduism or the various different tribes which dominated the subcontinent, you found that God delivered a message in the words of a culture. But nevertheless, if he would have sent it in Arabic, for example, the Hindus would never have understood that. So the reality is that God, wherever he shifts his religion, he sends it in a particular context as well. To give you another example, if Sanskrit was to be revealed in for example, Arabia, the people wouldn't understand. The reality of a religion is the way that it blends an abstract form within the culture and the practices of the society. That's what really makes it. So for example, Christianity, when it came down to a particular people. And if you look at the movement of Jesus, it was upon Judaism itself. After that, then it spread. When you go to the core of any religion, you found that there is a transcendental nature, that every human being is transpiring for two things, essentially. And this is what we debate in logic. And especially when we come into theology, we say the same thing as well. That there are two things that every human being is looking for, and the reason why you follow a religion today is because of twofold. Otherwise, you just wouldn't follow it. The first is because religion facilitates inner peace for you. All of those many problems in the world. If there was no peace within religion, you wouldn't follow it. And the second thing, that man has been created for perfection. Every human being, from Adam all the way down to the final human being who will come, two things that we are looking for in our life: perfection and peace. Peace and tranquility within ourselves, and perfection in terms of our various faculties. Now, what do I mean by this? You see, essentially, the Quran says, and if you look at the other scriptures as well, they say that man was created, for example, in the image of God. And in the same way you find in the Quran that says man was created in the surah of God. So really, when you ask a Muslim, for example, that when you talk about God being, or man being created in the image of God, is that something which is physical? Because if it's physical, you'd be restricting God. So is it something greater than that? And we've said that, look, what this technically means is it means the character of God. Or as we would say in Islam, the akhlaq of God. I.e. those characteristics that God has, that ethics that God has, the morality of God is found within every human being. See, this ethics or this morality which is found within your primordial nature, and the term the Quran uses is fitra. A lot of times we as Muslims, we say, well, fitra means eating, sleeping, mating, producing, but it's not the case. Fitra is something which is specific only for man. And when you go deep inside of it, you realize that when God talks about creating man on his form, he He talks about this essential goodness which is found within God, that's found within man. And so this is why Islam says that every human being was born good. You don't find any contradiction to that. Why? Because you're created in the image of God. And what this means is that in your primordial nature, you aspire towards goodness and ultimately God. And I'll give you an example. A lot of times we do this in our daily life. You wake up in the morning, you may have a shave, you comb your hair, you put a bit of perfume on. What's the purpose of this? Inherently, this is perfection of beauty which is coming out, and that's found within God. Or in the same way, you see a person crossing the road, and they can't cross, they're old maybe. And inside of you tells you to help them. There's a compassion there. Regardless of what religion you are, color you are, race you are, there is a compassion found within human beings. And that compassion is found within all of us. That's the reality of God within you. So in this way, if I was to really start this journey, and that was just an introduction, the reality is this, that you find God in his essence, that Islam says, غيب الغيوب. He was hidden. He was a hidden treasure. No one knew him. 70,000 veils of darkness and lightness. And so what he does is he manifests himself. When he manifests himself, what you find is that from a central core, you find multiplicity from there. And so we said that he created the universe. And the universe around you, this multiplicity which you are seeing, are the actualizations of the name and the attributes of the Creator. And he scattered these things. So when you look around you, and it says in tradition, that wherever you turn, you find the face of God. Wherever you look, you find the signs of God. Because when God manifested himself, the scatteredness, this encompassing of the universe was found there. And not just in his physical form, within his metaphysical forms, in terms of the angels, in terms of the spiritual realms. So in this way, God manifested himself. Why? In another tradition it says, God says, I was a hidden treasure. I love to be found. And so I created. The idea of love and compassion comes there. The purpose of creation, the mercy, the divine mercy of God. And as we say, God is merciful. But God, without creating, cannot perfect the power of mercy. If you're merciful and you don't show that mercy, you don't reciprocate that, what happens is it remains dormant. In this way, God's merciful names manifested themselves to show mercy. And in this way, those names perfected. God was perfect, but his manifestation as names perfected themselves in creation. And so in this way, the key name that created all of the universe is the name Mercy, Rahmah of Allah. The idea that God is merciful. And so because of his mercy, he created creation. He expanded the entire universe because of this. But God says, look, from all of this scattering, from all of this plurality, he's one, he's unity. But in this way, he made plurality. All the various levels of creation, metaphysical and the physical levels, from one way to the other way, horizontally and vertically, he created the universe upon his mercy. But he says, listen, it's still not complete yet. And as the mystics have said, and you go into traditions and you find, whether it's Moses ben Maimonide, the Jew, or whether you look at somebody like Meister Eckhart, you find that there's this reality which is coming through that I mentioned at the beginning, the esoteric reality of religions. Each one of them say, they said that then God created man, right at the end. So a lot of times students ask, they say, well look, you say Adam was the first creation, then what about the dinosaurs? And I say, well look, it's not that. We say Adam was the first man on earth, the first human being. In fact, we say within mystical tradition, he was the last of all creation because he was the polish of God. So God created Adam then. And as the Quran says, I'm putting my khalifa, I'm putting my representative who will represent me on earth. What is Adam then? Essentially, Adam is this vast macrocosm of names brought onto one level of unity, which we call the microcosmic universe. Man, therefore, contains all of the realities of creation inside of himself. And this is why Imam Ali alayhi salam says in Nahj al-Balagha, beautifully he says, man, why do you look at yourself as such a small entity? You have the entire universe within yourself. If you look at Aristotle, he mentions four levels of creation within the physical world, whether it's the mineral level, or the vegetative level, or the animal level, or the angelic levels, all of these are found within man. All of the universe, then, all of these scattered names of God, all of this multiplicity and plurality of names, when you bring it to one locus, it equals man. And so for man you find that then God says in the Quran, I created man then in various languages, in male and female, in various colors, for one purpose, so they may be able to recognize one another. In another tradition, it says, in fact, it's mentioned in the Quran, it says, what is the purpose of man? What is the purpose of creating all of these things? Go into the Quran and see. God says that I've created man and jinn for one purpose, so that you may worship me. Somebody went to Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq and he asked him, he says, look, what does it mean when God says, worship him? It's rather boring if I've been created just to pray 5 times a day and fast. It's not really appealing. What does it essentially mean to worship God? And he says, the essential meaning of worship is to understand the perfection of God. It's to understand God in His beauty. Why? Because we're moving towards perfection. We feel that if we're perfection, or we find perfection within ourselves, what happens is that you remove negative suffering, and essentially your mind opens and expands to the realities of the creation and the Creator itself. Why is man therefore being created? To go towards perfection, to become divine. So in the way it says, that man becomes an annihilated form or a manifestation of God itself. What is man then? What is the perfect man? This Adam that God created. From these scattered names, the manifestation of God itself was found in Adam. And this is why in Hadith al-Qudsi it says, that nothing can contain me but the heart of man. The metaphysical heart that brings together all of the universe. And a lot of times I say, well look, man, don't sell yourself short. You know, we're trapped in this race of life. We don't go deeper inside to understand that our reality is just not work. It's not just going to university or colleges, which is a main part of our life, but our life is actually to understand and unravel the realities. And this isn't something which is restricted to only Muslims. When we mention at the beginning that God created the universe upon His mercy, He says, I'm the Rabbul Alameen, I'm the Lord of all of creation. He also said the Prophet is a mercy of all of creation as well. And so therefore the Prophet of God is not restricted to just Muslims. By the title of the Prophet mentioned in the Quran, the Prophet is a mercy on all of the creation, on all realities, from the physical lowest reality to the highest realities which are metaphysical. From multiplicity to the state of unity. In this way we say that God's names are multiple, brought together on one locus represents unity. In the same way, when you look at mankind scattered, brought together on one level, you're humanity. And in this way, when the Quran addresses humanity itself, and you find that the Quran probably is the only book from all of the religious books that addresses all of humanity. Ya ayyuhan nas, O people. It doesn't say, O Muslims only. And it does in certain places. It says, O Muslims, O Christians, O Jews. But essentially it says, O humanity, O people. And so in this way, the Quran itself is saying, I'm not restricted only to Muslims. And this Prophet is not just restricted. And so then we say, that from the beginning when God created Adam, the purpose of Adam then, as a guide for humanity, no one can say that there was no guide. God created that guide to facilitate man's movement back towards Him from the lowest level. And the question which is asked is this, why was man delivered to the lowest level? Why to the world of multiplicity? When we talk about the hereafter, and we talk about the grave, and we talk about these other realities, we go back to this philosophy that from multiplicity we'll go towards unity. We'll become singular again. So why is it then God sent us in a world full of multiplicity, where God Himself says that I'm at unity? The reason is this, that He wanted man to experience the various levels of creation itself. So He said that until you can't experience the lowest level, you can't experience the highest level. Within multiplicity you will find me. And a question is asked, look, the angels, man has been created higher than the angels, but the angels reside in a land which is at unity. And we've said, we've been told that we're greater than animals. So why is it that we reside in the physical world? And the answer is just there. Because we need to taste and experience all the different realities of creation. The lowest reality is its multiplicity. Where you find multiplicity and physics, you find suffering. This is why we suffer. This is why we have suffering in the world. Because physics means it's restricted. And so we're restricted in this way because of the physical confinements that we have. Because of the parameters which we have. But as you've looked at the traditions, after death, these sufferings stop. You remove yourself. You brush off the physical reality. And you go towards a unity. And it's at this point of unity where peace lies. So why am I building this up? What has this got to do with plurality then? You see, if you understand the essential nature of the Prophet, the message of the Prophet, you'll understand exactly what he means and the spirit of plurality which he was trying to teach. So in this way, you find that 124,000, as Muslims say, prophets came. You have a whole corpus of them in the Bani Israel, the Jews, and again, Muslims believe in the Jewish prophets, because the Quran says, it says, we're not here to negate the religions. We affirm all religions. That's the reality. But we are a continuation and a completion. We believe in Abraham. We believe in him as a prophet. And we believe in him as infallible. He doesn't make a mistake. We believe in David. We believe in Solomon. They're prophets. They're infallible. We believe in Isaac. We believe in Jesus. But the reality is that we believe in another prophet who's the seal of the prophets. What he does is he takes all of these messages and he refines them. What do I mean by this? You see, every prophet had a different function. If you look at Abraham, he had a different function from Moses. What was the function of Moses? To emancipate a nation from the slavery of the Pharaoh. After doing this, what was the first thing he essentially did? He created parameters. 10 commandments came. A Sharia, so-called, came. Laws. The purpose of these laws? To regulate man. What's the message that we're taking from this? The message is this, that we first and foremost need to take care of our societies. Before spiritualism came, before mysticism came, before a form of theology was developed, the first thing that Moses does is he gives us parameters. He says, look, these are parameters that you need to live by. I've made you restricted in a particular way. The reason being is that you're scattered otherwise. You have thousands of thoughts in your mind. I want to take you towards unity from this multiplicity. And the easiest example is in our daily life. Holidays come. You've got 6 weeks off. First week you enjoy yourself. By the second week you're depressed. Those parameters have gone. In the same way you retire and you're looking forward to it. You know, I want to go to Wales, settle down, or maybe Las Vegas or something. And after the first 3 weeks in Las Vegas, you're like, look, I'm bored now. I've done everything. No restraints. I'm waking up at 11 o'clock. I'm going to sleep at 3 in the morning. No restraints. What happens? Depression. From there onwards, it's a spiral. What has God done? He's given you certain formats. He says, for your perfection, for the balancing of thousands of different emotions inside of you, I've given you something. And it's important for you to follow it. By following it, you stay in a state of balance. And otherwise, you find that it begins to shred off. That balance goes then. After that, you find Jesus came. Islamically, what's the purpose of Jesus? To introduce as the spirit of the law, to remove the rigidity which was developing then. And today when we talk about Islamic fundamentalism, it's rigid. The purpose of Islam is not rigidity. It's to introduce a spirit of the law, and this is what Jesus was doing. He said to the rabbis, look, it's rigid. So Islam says the purpose of Jesus then was to remove this rigidity. He said, look deeper inside of it. And so then after that, the final prophet comes. So really, what's his purpose? You've got spirituality with Jesus. You've got laws with Moses. You've got a theology. You've got everything there. What's the purpose of the prophet then? Why does he come down? As societies changed, a new prophet came down, right? Help the societies, help those civilizations. And when the problems changed, again another prophet came. Jesus has come now. Now come the final prophet. What's his purpose? Allama Tabatabai very famously says, he says that each one of the prophets are a manifestation of God, are a name of God. But the final prophet brings all of these manifestations onto one locus. He says, if you want to see the beauty of Jesus, look at the final prophet. He says, if you want to see the majesty of Moses, look at the final prophet. If you want to see all of these manifestations, look at the final prophet. He brings together everything. He is the microcosm. So now the question is this, what is the purpose of that final prophet? Did he come to say, pray 5 times a day? No. Did he come and say, go on the Hajj, and believe me, it's 55 degrees in summer, you don't want to go there. Is that the reason why? Did he come and say, look, give charity? No. One thing he said. You know what that was? One reality. Look at the prophet of God, what he says. He says that the only reason why I've been made into a prophet is to perfect your etiquettes and morality. That's my reason. Everything else is there. I've come to make you human beings. As Aristotle said, we are rational animals. That rational side of us which differentiates us from animals, its perfection lies in your ethics and morality. He says, I've come to make you human beings. I've come to take you towards perfection. I've come to take society, in essence, towards perfection. And this is why, as Muslims, we say that it's the most encompassing. Social policy, economic policies, you find, for example, ethics. Everything is contained within Islam. This is why we have a political system. Even though after the Prophet and Imam Ali, you don't find a system as perfect as this, but the reality is that there is a system there in place. Because Islam identifies that man is not singular, he's compound. So the reality of a person is compound means if you're going to go to your perfection, and if you're going to find peace as a community, it's important for you to take care of that community within itself. Purpose of the Prophet then, to cater for all of these different faculties within our society and within ourselves. As the Quran says, it says that when you're walking towards perfection, as you're going towards perfection, we will show you our signs in multiplicity and plurality. That's why we created a world which is pluralistic. And in the same way, we'll show you signs within yourself, and then only then will you go towards a perfection. Only then will you then achieve this perfection that we're talking about. So now it's the question is this. We've looked at the philosophy. I probably bored you with the philosophy. But the reality is there was a reason for this. And the reason is this. What is therefore the Prophet's approach? Knowing full well that the Quran talks about multiplicity and the idea of diversity, religions have been spread. And the Prophet is saying this. To follow me is to follow all of the other prophets, which means is to follow diversity. Is to follow Jewish prophets, as well as those prophets who may have come in the subcontinent. Is to follow those prophets who may have been in Europe. There's a diversity there. But he says, look, I've come with Islam. And the actual essence of Islam is to go back to its nature, submission to the will of the Creator. In fact, submission to its perfection. Going from this multiplicity, appreciating multiplicity, and also appreciating the unity which is God as well. And so here you find the Prophet comes. And in the space of maybe 23 years of his prophethood, you find that there are dealings which he has in two ways. In 23 years, 13 years are spent in Mecca, 10 of those years are spent in Medina. 13 years are spent with polytheists, 10 years are spent with Jews and Christians, people of the book. In fact, in this 23 years, all of those people who were there in terms of their beliefs, whether you believed in multiple gods, as polytheism does, or in a way you believed in the Abrahamic religions, both sides of the life of the Prophet is mentioned. Both sides are there to give a kind of advice to Muslims who are going to come. I've been there. I've dealt with people, and I've been successful in the way that I've been dealing with people. My purpose, as a mercy for all of them, to facilitate perfection for all of them. And so the very first thing which he says, and if you look at tradition, you find that at the age of 40, he gathers in front of all of the polytheists, and he says to them, he says, look, you've seen my life. What would you say of two things about me which stand out? They said, well, two things are that you are truthful and you are trustworthy. These are those two fundamental qualities that are required to develop any society. Confucius once said to one of the kings, he says, look, if you want to develop a society, a cosmopolitan society, a society which is developed and well-rooted, there are three things which you need. He says, firstly, you need to give them food. You've got to feed them. If you don't feed them, they're not going to respond to you. Secondly, you've got to give them weapons to be able to protect themselves. And thirdly, you've got to win their trust. But know one thing. If you can't give them weapons, give them food, fill their stomachs. And if you can't give them a way of protecting themselves or food, win their trust. If you win their trust, they'll be willing to die for you even. This is what we see in the feature of the Prophet. He says, look, what are the two qualities about me? He said, you're trustworthy and you're truthful. Automatically a community then forms. And these people are willing to die for him, willing to give everything to him because of these qualities. He'd won their hearts. He'd taken their emotion. And as it says in the Quran, he didn't force anyone. The first charter, he said, there is no compulsion in religion. You could be whatever you want. But the main thing is this reality of humanity. The idea that we need to work together. The idea that we need to build these bonds. We're on this world, right? The purpose of us being here is to facilitate ourselves to go towards perfection. We're going towards a creator. We're there to give ourselves peace. We're moving towards perfection. That means then, we need to work together. If I'm living with you in Mecca, and you don't believe in the same religion as I do, if we're at war with each other, we can't go towards perfection. It affects me and my development, and it affects you and your development as well. So the first thing the Prophet of God said, he said, there's no compulsion here. But what I want you to realize, essentially, and if we look at it in a philosophical way, is I want you to realize, away from the multiplicity, the idea of unity, the idea of God as well, I want you to taste the other side as well. You've tasted the side of plurality, but at the same time, I want you to taste unity as well. So he says to the people, he says, look, come towards this unity because it's for your benefit. But in a way, if you don't believe in it, that's fine. And so for the first 13 years, he spends his time, he spends every moment that he has, he spends it with the people, developing them, opening their minds, broadening them to say, look, the first things which you need to do is to think. This is what he says. It says, man, and if you go into the Quran, and it's amazing the way the Quran mentions this, but Muslims unfortunately don't look at it. Every other page, why don't you think? Why don't you ponder? Why are you so rigid for? Why don't you open your mind? Why don't you delve deeper? Why isn't there peace inside of you? All of these things are suggested, but today Muslims don't look at that. It says, ponder over things. Broaden your minds. Appreciate people. Ethos of the Quran. Today, people are not appreciating themselves. In fact, this isn't just a problem with Muslims. Despite the fact that there's globalization today and we're meant to be technically coming together, you find that we've moved apart. There's a lot of misinformation which is there. We're not thinking. Whatever the media says, we pick up. And at the same time, we follow whatever somebody tells us. We don't research into it. We don't go deeper into it. We don't go and make our own opinions. And sometimes it's important to make your own opinions. We're just following. And this is why then it says in the Quran, وَلَكِنْ أَكْثَرُ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. Unfortunately, the majority of people, they don't think. They don't know. They're ignorant because of the fact that they're restricted. Open your minds. That's the first 13 years of the Prophet. He's saying, look, it's important for you to open your minds and think to appreciate one another. From then onwards, then he migrates to Medina. The purpose of this migration, look at tradition and you'll see. Why does he migrate there? Sanctuary. Who was giving him that sanctuary? The Jews and the Christians. From the first day that he walks in, and this is a message, and this is the way that he was facilitating. He comes into Medina. The first thing that he does is he establishes a mosque. The purpose of that mosque is to bring people together on one platform. He invites the Jews and the Christians who are living there, and he says, come, let's sign a pact. Let's develop this Medina. Let's look after each other. Come, let's make brotherhood with each other. Let's work together. And he builds this. He says the first thing in any society which is important is centralization. This is why in the Islamic world we have the Jamaats. Wherever we go in the world, wherever we migrate, the first thing which we do, let's say we came to London 50 years ago, we created a Jamaat because this is from the tradition of the Prophet. You come, you centralize so that you can help each other. You can develop each other. Then the Prophet says, he says, we are all brothers. There's a universal brotherhood, which means you take care of me and I take care of you. There is no competition, negative competition amongst us. There's no stabbing each other in the backs or backbiting or slandering or any of these things. We've migrated from Mecca, but we've made brotherhood with you. And so that means that you help us and we help you. Social policies are not developing here. And then after this you find that from the first day age to the 10th day age, to the final moments of his life, he passed away in the first 2 months, within the 11th age, he begins a systematic policy of bringing together people on a social level and to establish for them a community. You don't find this within history. Maybe within religions, after the founder of a religion, so to speak, has passed away, 100, 200, 300, even 1,000 years later, there may be a development of a society. But what you're finding is that in the lifetime of the Prophet himself, what he does is that he creates a society and he brings the Jews and the Christians who are living there on this platform. And he says a very beautiful thing. He says, look, I'm not going to force my religion upon you. In this society, Jews, you rule your own community according to the Torah, and Christians, you follow your own Bible. We have a pact though. You follow your own system there, but we have a pact. And that pact means that we have to facilitate peace and mutual cooperation. We don't want to destroy this. If we were to destroy this, it would remove our peace. It would remove us going towards this perfection. So that's what he does. And the only time you find within history this takes place again is in the time of Imam Ali, where he comes into Kufa and he says to the people, oh people, know that even though I am the Khalifa of the time, but I will judge the Jews according to the Torah, the Muslims according to the Quran, and the Christians according to the Bible. What your religion is, that's what your religion is. You should have the autonomy, therefore, to be able to worship and to be able to have rulings amongst yourselves. But there's one thing that they say, and that is that he says, well, look, you've got to give us the jizya, the poll tax. The purpose of this poll tax for your own protection. And I remember I was once lecturing at a university, somebody asked me, they said, well, look, how would you feel like if we charged you poll tax? I said, you know what, I'd love it. You give me a part of Wales and I'll make it into Dubai. The reason being is that once I give you the poll tax, income tax goes out the window, VAT goes out the window, inheritance tax goes out the window, because what Islam was saying to the Jews and the Christians were, all of our taxes are exempt from you, the only thing you do is poll tax for protection. And that's to make sure that the society is systematically running. This is what it was. There was an elaborate system then that was created. That's on a social level. That's the plurality of the Prophet in the basis of this. But there's a second thing which he does as well. And you don't find this within history. He creates the first social welfare system. And the funny thing is that within this welfare system, he says that the minister of this is my daughter Zahra. So the first minister of social networking, you could say, within the Islamic system was a woman. And today there's no emphasis which is given on that. Plurality just doesn't mean us and our relationship with other religions. Pluralism means across the board, especially when it comes to genderism. The Prophet's family has led this way on this. You go back and see, if the Muslims today are pushing women away, and I say this in terms of stereotype, inshallah they're not. But if they are, go back to the tradition of the Prophet. The first person or the first woman was his wife Khadija. It was her, it was her social policy, it was her money, it was her wealth that facilitated for Islam. Islam wouldn't be here, and the Prophet emphasizes this. If it wasn't for Khadija, I wouldn't be here. Second person, his daughter, Zahra, Fatima to Zahra, if you look at it, the entire social policy was in the hands of a woman. When the Prophet of God went out, you found that this woman was the one who was dealing. Women would come and say, our husbands have questions. We have questions. What should we be doing? How should we be developing the society? And the third woman you find, and again from within the family of the Prophet, the Ahlul Bayt, is Sayyida Zainab, a woman who took the message of Imam Hussein forward. And we don't have enough time to go into who Imam Hussein was. But the idea is this, that the women of the family of the Prophet have worked hand in hand. And essentially this is really the only religion that you find that the women and men have worked different mechanics, but in the same way they've worked together. And unfortunately we as Muslims don't emphasize this. We've marginalized many a time our women. But the reality is Islam flourished when both were working hand in hand, when both communities and societies were working. So here you have a Medina. In terms of its social networking, you have Jews and Christians on a particular council. You have the Prophet of God, you're finding him at the top. You find women in terms of his own family who are there. This social system is developed for people who are poor, for widowers and for orphans. Three categories of people were then covered. That's on the basis of society though. But you look at it, the Prophet is not restricted to just that. Look at the spirituality of the Prophet as well. The idea that he was promoting a form of spirituality which was reviving the spirituality of Jesus when it came to the way that he was talking with Christians. And then the idea of the mosaic spirituality, whether it's the Kabbalah system which later on developed, it's an offshoot of this. The idea was that the Prophet was teaching mysticism on this way as well. He was dealing with people in their language. If you go back to books like Kitab al-Tawheed, you're seeing the Prophet's dialogue on the basis of the Bible, on the basis of the Torah. And in fact there are traditions that says that the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, and there's a one particular one that he deals with the Vedas as well. So in a way, if you go to Kitab al-Tawheed, there was a Hindu that came. And it says in the tradition, in Sanskrit, the Imam replies. And he references it back to the Vedas. So it's not something which is restricted to one book. There is this transcendental nature across these religions that they're trying to promote. The spirituality is there. The economic policy is there. The social policy is there. 23 years of the life of the Prophet though. And there are many incidences that have taken place as well within that. You found that the Prophet had pacts, he had agreements. The Pact of Medina is a very famous one that brought together all of these different religions onto one platform. The Prophet had this, but it was only 23 years of it. How do we apply this in our time? And what was really the practical application of the life of the Prophet? You see, the best image that we find of the Prophet, because at this stage the Islamic government wasn't vast, But by the time it was, you find the living embodiment of the Prophet in Imam Ali alayhi salam. And this is the reality. If you go back to his caliphate, you re-find that the justice of the Prophet and the mercy of the Prophet was expounded in these 4.5 years. Look at what Ali says. Look at the beauty of the way that he addresses. Go to Nahj al-Balagha and see. In one letter of his, that in 2002, the United Nations, when they suggested to the Arab League, they said, look, if you want to sort your affairs out, go back to what Ali is saying. Go back 1400 years ago and look at the Charter of Rights that he writes in the way that he's telling his governors how to rule. You know, I remember a friend of mine many years ago, he says, when I was in India with Rajiv Gandhi, he said, I walked into his drawing room and I saw this charter plastered on his wall. So I asked him, I said, why don't you put it outside? Why'd you put it inside? He says that this was gifted to me by someone, by one of your colleagues. But the reason why I put it inside is because I want to make this personal to me. It's as if Ali is talking to me on how to rule. And if you go into this charter, you'll see that one of the most beautiful lines that everyone mentions, and today it's plastered all over the Muslim world, is when Imam Ali says to Malik al-Ashtar, he says, look Malik, you're going to Egypt as my governor, but know there'll be many people there who are not from your denomination or your religion. So remember one thing, either people are your brothers in humanity or they're your brothers in religion. If you remember this, that personal relationship will remain. And with this, those barriers and those bonds will be destroyed. That was that purpose. This is what Imam Ali is teaching us. The idea that break those barriers. Remember, you are brothers either within society, humanity, or within religion. Break those bounds. Come together. Accommodate one another. Without this accommodation, you'll find that nothing is achieved then. Essential message of the Prophet then. And again, this is repeated with Imam Ali. And remember, Imam Ali's that child who from the age of when he was born to the age that the Prophet passed away, lived with the Prophet. He brought up the Prophet of God, brought up Imam Ali. And he says a very famous saying of the Prophet of God. And it was in a battlefield. And it says when the enemy attacked him, and they said one of the good qualities of Ali was that when it came to war, there's something which is known as ethics, which may not be found today within certain places of the world when it comes to war, but you found that with Imam Ali. He never attacked. And he was there and he was discussing with the people. He was saying, look, we're not here to fight you. We want peace, but if you want to fight, then I'll protect myself. Somebody comes to him and they ask him, they say, Ya Ali, tell me, what is the reality? What is Islam? They thought, well, look, he's going to give a speech for 24 hours. Trying to explain what Islam is, this function and that function. And Ali turns around and he says very beautifully, he says, no, Islam is two things. That's it, that's all he said. Islam is two things. Your duty to God and your duty to humanity. Your duty to humanity means that even if, God forbid, there is war, there is ethics there. And Ali says, don't chop down trees. If somebody's running away from you, they've got their back turned to you. Don't harm them. No women and children. Don't break roads. Don't do anything like that. The idea is ethics and morality, even at the lowest level, even when it comes to war. He says, because maybe by your ethics, you may change a person. And this is why in the Battle of Badr, for example, afterwards, and the Prophet of God said, he said, tell me, how many people have you spread the religion to? Because as the Prophet said, that look, whoever teaches a Muslim to read and write, you're free to go. And he looks towards the companions and he says, well, who's actually conveyed the message? And they said, well, only one person has, and that's Ali. How does he do it? Ask him. Went to him. Said, Ya Ali, tell us. Oh, Ali, tell us. What is it that you do? He says, why don't you ask those people who you call your enemies, but I call my friends. Ask them. See what they say. So they looked up and they said, well, there's a quality about Ali which is appealing to us. He says, what is it? He said, well, you've been fighting him. He says, well, that's exactly what it is. He's courageous on the battlefield. He has morality there. He doesn't attack you first. He doesn't fight you. There's a morality about him. And he fights with courage. And he fights with ethics. But after the war and after the battle, when it came to talking and dialogue, he says, you guys stand up in front of us because you're the victors. But when it comes to Ali, he sits down on his knees, puts his head down humbly, and he talks to us with ethics and manners, even though we were enemies on the battlefield. He says, that's the thing that we like about him. This is why we want to come onto his way. This is why we love him. And it says in the tradition, and he says, well, look, this is what I've learned from the Prophet. that even on the darkest moments, even when you're despairing on a battlefield, let's say, there's ethics there. To say that prophets haven't fought wars? No, David fought. You found that there are different prophets who have fought. Sometimes you have to defend yourself as well. But there's an ethics and a morality which goes there. And this is really the essence of plurality, essentially. The idea that almost you become selfless. Humanity as one unit, as the Quran talks about it, to address it, to go deeper inside of it, requires us to destroy our egos. To now go back to the very first thing that I said. If God created us on His image, the idea for us to attain God is the breaking away of the human ego. When the human ego dies, only then does the birth of a godly ego comes within you. And that godly ego is essential for us to look at multiplicity and unity in multiplicity. Thank you very much.